You're listening to a London Review of Books podcast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this year's series of LRB lectures held at the British Museum. As you know, there are always three of these lectures, and they're a very important annual feature in our calendar, appearing like a comet in our sky. And as always with comets, or at least the better class of comet, huge crowds gather. And I'm very pleased indeed that so many of you are here this evening for this year's first LRB lecture. It's a chance for me to say thank you to the London Review of Books and to Mary Kay Wilmers for having established this pattern, which allows us to think about aspects of what the museum does in a completely different way. And a chance of thanking Hilary Mantel for coming this evening to talk about the Tudor court. As you all know, the characters in Wolf Hall and in Bring Up the Bodies are characters that we feel we've known all our lives. We know how every one of them died, usually in the same way, we know something of how they lived. But if we know them largely through Holbein, we know them one by one, as individual portraits by the greatest portraitist. We know them, if you like, as a series of soliloquies. What Hilary Mantel has done is turn these soliloquies into a conversation, into a real set of dialogues, a world of conversation, a party where all these people not just interact with each other, but observe each other at court. And as we know from Holbein, above all, that court was a dangerous place without a friend. And even with a friend, in this marvelous portrait of the ambassadors, it's a world freighted with high learning, high doctrine, and high politics. And Holbein shows us how, at this court, it's very hard to see everything, even the most important details, risk being missed, risk being partly concealed one way or another. But above all, this is a court at which it's very hard to see straight. It's a world where you keep losing perspective. That well-known skull in the front is completely illegible straight on. It's only when you stand in a certain position that you have that transient privilege of a coherent view. And that's not just a figure of speech. I think it's clear that for people at the Tudor court, the fact that you couldn't see straight, that there were distortions built into daily life, was a very profound reality. Because Holbein, of course, is not the only artist to do this. Around the corner in the National Portrait Gallery is the famous William Scrodd's portrait of Edward VI. Distorted, disturbing, face on, but falling into place, taking coherence, making sense, only from one particular point of view, one particular viewpoint. Standing in the wings, you can see the king as he is. It's a selective, restrictive, off-center view. And fascinating, I think very appropriately, in the portrait gallery, you can only see it from that little hole on the right. And it's a point of view that no one is allowed to occupy for very long. In an emblem of what happens to those who can see the king straight, you're very quickly dislodged from your position by the next spectator. And the spectator, of course, through whom we now all see the Tudor court, is Thomas Cromwell. And these books have changed the way that we can look at these people, because we now know them in a very different sort of way. And those of you who have visited the Queen's Gallery recently and the exhibition of the Northern Renaissance from the Royal Collection will, I'm sure, like me, have had that very disturbing sense of entering a world where you know all these people because Hilary Mantel has introduced you to them. We know them so well that we have, in a very real sense, become them. We can see it straight We can see it without the distortion, and that's because the Master of Transformation has made that possible. She is this evening's speaker, but she is, in a very real sense, more than this evening's speaker. She enables us to move in and out of the court of Henry VIII, and she's done it in a way that has been universally recognized as exceptional. Literary prizes have rained down on her as orders of chivalry rained down on Henry VIII. Having carried off the garter with bar, she's now recently carried off the golden fleece. And it is, therefore, an enormous pleasure and a great honour to ask you all to welcome this evening Hilary Mantel. Thank you very much.
Good evening. Last summer at the festival at Hay-on-Wye, I was asked to name a famous person and choose a book to give them. I know they are so tiresome, these little quizzes. Who would be the guests at your ideal dinner party? And what book has changed your life? And what fictional character do you most resemble? Which I always think is for other people to say, really. However, I had to come up with an answer, famous person, book for a present. So I chose Kate, the Duchess of Cambridge, and I chose to give her a book published in 2006 by the cultural historian Caroline Weber. It's called Queen of Fashion, What Marie Antoinette Wore to the Revolution. It's not that I think we're heading for a revolution. It's rather that I saw Kate becoming a jointed doll on which certain rags are hung. In those days, she was just a shop window mannequin with no personality of her own, entirely defined by what she wore. And these days, as a mother-to-be, she's draped in another set of threadbare attributions. Once she gets over being sick, the press will decide she's radiant. And they will find that this young woman's life, till now, was nothing. Her only point and purpose, like other royal ladies we'll come to, her only point and purpose being to give birth. Now, Marie Antoinette, of course, was a woman eaten alive by her frocks. She was transfixed by appearances, stigmatized by her fashion choices. Politics were made personal in her. Her greed for self-gratification, her half-educated dabbling in public affairs, were reduced as a reason why the French nation was bankrupt and miserable. And it was ridiculous, of course. She was one individual with limited power and influence who focused the rays of misogyny. She was a woman who couldn't win. If she wore fine fabrics, as she did in her early portraits, she was accused of extravagance. But if she wore those simple, almost transparent linens, dressing up as a shepherdess, she was accused of plotting to ruin the Lyon silk trade. But, you know, in truth, she was all body and no soul. No soul, no sense, no sensitivity. When the royal family made their desperate escape from Paris, dashing for the border, Antoinette couldn't get into her head that this had to be kept secret. So she had several trunkloads of new clothes made and sent on in advance. And she took her hairdresser along on the trip. Despite the weight of those mountainous hairdos, she couldn't feel her head wobbling on her shoulders. And when she returned from that trip to Paris, which would become a kind of prison for her, then it was said that her hair had turned grey overnight, which saved the trouble of powdering it. Now, as a royal consort, Antoinette was a smiling, gliding disaster, much like Diana in another time, in another country. But Kate Middleton, as she was, appeared to have been designed by a committee and built by craftsmen with a perfect plastic smile and the spindles of her limbs hand-turned and gloss-varnished. When it was announced that Diana was to join the royal family, the Duke of Edinburgh is said to have given her his approval because she would, I quote, breed in some height. Now, presumably Kate was designed to breed in some manners because, you know, she looks like a nicely brought up young lady with please and thank you as part of her vocabulary. But that first official portrait, unveiled a few weeks ago by Paul Emsley, her eyes are dead, and she wears the strange smile of a woman who really wants to tell the painter to bugger off. One critic perceptively said she appeared weary of being looked at. And another said that the portrait might pass muster as the cover of a Catherine Cookson novel, which I find thought-provoking because Cookson's simple tales of poor women extricating themselves from adverse circumstances and rising in the world, they were for 20 years, according to the public lending rights statistics, the nation's favourite reading. Sue Townsend said of Diana that she was a fatal non-reader. Diana didn't know the end of her own story. She only enjoyed the romances of Barbara Cartland. And of course, I'm far too snobbish to have read one. But I assume that they are stories in which a wedding takes place and they all live happily ever after. And Diana didn't see the possible twists in the narrative. Now, what does Kate read? It's a question. Kate seems to have been selected for her role of princess because she was irreproachable, as painfully thin as anyone could wish, without quirks, without oddities, without the risk of the emergence of character. Machine-made, precision-made. So different from Diana, whose human awkwardness and emotional incontinence showed in every gesture. Diana could transform herself from galumping schoolgirl to ice queen, from wraith to Amazon. And Kate seems capable of going from perfect bride to perfect mother with no messy deviation. When her pregnancy became public, she'd been visiting her old school, and she picked up a hockey stick and run a few paces for the camera. And BBC News devoted a discussion as to whether a pregnant woman could safely put on a turn of speed while wearing high heels. And it's really sad to think that intelligent people can devote themselves to such a topic with earnest furrowings of the brow. But that, you see, is what discourse about royals come to. There is a compulsion to comment. You have to find something to say. The discourse is mouthed rather than spoken. And in the same way, one is compelled to look at them. The gaze is drawn to ask what are they made of? And is their substance the same as that of us plebs? I used to think the interesting question was whether we should have a monarchy or not. But now I think the question's like, that question is rather like, should we have pandas or not? Our royal family don't have the same difficulty in breeding that pandas do. But pandas and royal persons alike are expensive to conserve and ill-adapted to any modern environment. But aren't they interesting? Aren't they nice to look at? Some people find them endearing. Some people pity them for their precarious situation. Everybody stares at them, and however airy the enclosure they inhabit, it's still a cage. And what they see are the curious spectators looking at them, and then the turned backs of those spectators as they walk away. A few years ago, I saw the Prince of Wales at a public awards ceremony. I'd never seen him before, and at once I thought, what a beautiful suit. What sublime tailoring. You see, it's for Shakespeare to penetrate the heart of a prince, and it's for me to study his cuff buttons. I found it hard to see the man inside the clothes. And like Thomas Cromwell in my novels, I couldn't help winding the fabric back onto the bolt and pricing him by the yard. And at this ceremony, which was formal and carefully orchestrated, the prince gave an award to a young author who deliberately came up on stage in shirt sleeves to receive his check. He no doubt wished to show that he was a free spirit, despite taking money from the establishment. And for a moment, I was ashamed of my trade. I thought, this is what royals nowadays have to contend with. Not real principled opposition, but self-congratulatory chippiness. Then as we drifted away from the stage, I saw something else. I glanced sideways into a room off the main hall, and I saw that it was full of stacking chairs. A depressing, institutional, impersonal sight. And I thought, Charles must see this all the time. Glance sideways into the wings, and you see the tacky preparations going on for the public triumph. You see your beautiful suit deconstructed, the tailor's chalk lines, the unsecured seams. You see your life is a charade. The scenery is flimsy and cardboard, the paint is peeling, the red carpet fraying. And if you linger, you will notice the oily devotion fade from the face of your subjects, and you will see their retreating backs as they turn up their collars and button their coats and walk away into real life. Then, a little later, I went to Buckingham Palace for a book trade event. It was a large evening party, and it may be that some of you in the book trade were there. And I found my expectations defeated. I'd expected to see people pushing themselves into the Queen's path, but the opposite was true. The Queen walked through the reception areas at an even pace, hoping to meet someone. And you would see a set of guests, as if swept by the tide, parting before her or welling ahead of her into the next room. And they acted as if they feared excruciating embarrassment if they were caught and had to converse. The self-possessed became gauche. The eloquent were struck dumb. The guests studied the wall, the floors. They looked everywhere except at Her Majesty. They studied exhibits in glass cases and the paintings on the walls, which, of course, were worth looking at. But they studied them with great intentness, as if their eyes had been glued. Vermeer was just then having a moment, as they say, and the guests congregated around a small Vermeer, huddled with their backs to the room, and I pushed through to see the painting along with others. But I can't remember now which painting it was. It's safe to say there would have been a luminous face, round or oval. There would have been a woman gazing, entranced at some household object, or perhaps reading a letter with a half smile. There may have been a curtain suggestive of veiled meaning. There would have been an enigma. And we concentrated on the painting at the expense of the enigma moving amongst us, smiling with gallant determination. And then the Queen passed close to me, and I stared at her. I am ashamed to say it now, but I passed my eyes over her as a cannibal views his dinner. My gaze sharp enough to pick the meat off her bones. I felt that such was the force of my devouring curiosity that the party had dematerialized and the walls had melted and there were only two of us in the vast room. And such was the hard power of my stare that Her Majesty turned and looked back at me as if she'd been jabbed in the shoulder. And for a split second, her face expressed not anger, but hurt bewilderment. And she looked young, as if for a moment she turned back from a figurehead into the young woman she was, before monarchy froze her and made her a thing which only had meaning when it was exposed, a thing that existed only to be looked at. And I felt sorry then. I wanted to apologize. I wanted to say, it's nothing personal. It's monarchy I'm staring at. And I rejoined mentally the rest of the guests. And now flunkies were moving amongst us with trays, and on them were canapes. And these party snacks were the Queen's revenge on her guests. They were pieces of grisly meat on skewers. Let's not to put too fine a point on it. They were kebabs. It took some time for each guest to chew through one of them. And then the guests were left with the little sticks in their hands. They tried to give them back to the flunkies, but the flunkies smiled in a sad and superior fashion, and they shook their heads and they moved away, so that the guests had to carry on the evening holding them out, like children with sparklers on Guy Fawkes night. At this point, the evening became all too much for me. It was so violently interesting. So I went behind a sofa and I sat on the floor and enjoyed the rest of the party that way, seeking privacy as my sympathies shifted. And as the guests ebbed away and the rooms emptied, I joined them. And on the threshold, I looked back. And what I saw, placed precisely at the base of every pillar, was a forest of little sticks, gnawed and abandoned. So if the Queen's glance had swept the room, that's what she would have seen, what we had left in our wake. It was the stacking chairs all over again, the scaffolding of reality too nakedly displayed, and the daylight let in upon magic. We can be sure the Queen was not traumatized by my staring, because the next time we met, she gave me a medal. And as I prepared to go to the palace, people would say, "Will it be the actual Queen, the Queen herself?" As if contact with the anointed hand would change you. And perhaps that is what the guests at the palace feared, to be changed by powerful royal magic without knowing how. The faculty of awe remains intact for all that the royal story in recent years has taken a sordid turn. Of course, there have been scandals enough in centuries past, from the sneaky little adulteries of Catherine Howard to the junketings of the Prince Regent to the more modern mischief of Mrs. Simpson. But I think a new world began in 1980 with the discovery that Diana, the future Princess of Wales, had legs. You may remember how the young Diana, taught for a few hours at a week at a kindergarten called Young England. And when it was first known that she was Charles's choice of bride, the press photographed her with the infants touchingly gathered around her, but they induced her to stand against the sunlight. So in the resulting photograph, the nation could see straight through her skirt. And a sort of horrible licentiousness took hold, a national lip smacking. Those gangling limbs artlessly exposed without her permission. And that was the first violation. When Diana drove to St. Paul's, she was a blur of virginal white behind glass. The public was waiting to see the dress, but this was more than a fashion moment. An everyday sort of girl had been squashed into the coach, but a goddess came out. She didn't get out of the coach in any ordinary way. She hatched. That extraordinary white dress came first. It was like a flow of liquid. It was like ectoplasm emerging from the orifices of a medium. And it was a long moment before she solidified. And indeed, the coach was a medium, a method of conveyance and communication between two spheres, the private and the public, the common and the royal. The dresser's first effect was dismaying. I shall never forget the moment because, in imagination, I could hear a nation of women catching their breath as one, not in awe, but in horror. It's creased to glory. How did they let that happen? I heard the squeak as a million ironing boards unfolded, and a sigh and a shudder as the collective nightmare came true. That dream we all have, that we are incorrectly dressed or not dressed at all, that we are naked in the street. But as the dress resolved about her, the princess was born and the world breathed out. Diana was more royal than the family she joined. That had nothing to do with family trees. Something in her personality, her receptivity, her passivity, fitted her to be the carrier of myth. She came near to claiming that she had the healing touch, the ancient attribute of royal persons. The healing touch can't be felt through white gloves. Diana walked barehanded among the multitude and unarmed, unfortified by irony, uninformed by history. Her tragedy was located in the gap between her human capacities and the demands of the superhuman role she was required to fulfill. When I think of Diana, I remember Stevie Smith's poem about the Lorelei. There, on a rock majestical, a girl with smile equivocal, painted and damned and young and fair, sits and combs her yellow hair. And soon Diana's hairstyles will be as consequential as Marie Antoinette's, and a great deal cheaper to copy. In the next stage of her story, at the world's hands, she passed through trials, through ordeals. For a time, the public refrained from demanding her blood, but she shed it anyway, cutting her arms and legs. Her death still makes me shudder because, although I know it was an accident, it wasn't just an accident. It was fate showing her hand, fate with her twisted grin. Diana went to the most feminine of cities to meet her end as a woman, to move on to the city of, from the city of light to the place beyond black. She went into the underpass to be reborn, but reborn this time without a physical body, the airy subject of 100,000 photographs, a flicker at the corner of the eye, a sigh on the breeze. For a time, it was hoped, and it was feared, that Diana had changed the nation. Her funeral was a pagan outpouring, a lawless fiesta of grief. We are bad at mourning our dead. We don't make time or space for grief. The world tugs us along, back into its harsh rhythm, before we're ready for it. And for the pain of loss, doctors will prescribe a pill. We're at war with our nature, and nature will win. All the bottled pain, all the grief dammed up, burst the barriers of formality and politeness and restraint, and broke down the divide between private and public, so that strangers wailed in the street. People who had never met Diana lamented her with maladjusted fervour, and we all remembered our secret pain and unleashed it in one huge carnival of mass mourning. But in the end, nothing changes. We were soon back to the prosaic, shirt sleeves, stacking chairs, little sticks. And yet, none of us who lived through it will forget that dislocating time when the skin came off the surface of the world and our inner vision cleared and we saw the archetypes clear and plain. And we saw the collective psyche at work and the gods pulling our strings. To quote Stevie Smith again, an antique story comes to me and fills me with anxiety. I wonder why I fear so much what surely has no modern touch. In looking at royalty, we're always looking at what's archaic, what's mysterious by nature. And my feeling is that it will only ever half reveal itself. And this poses a challenge to historians and to those of us who work imaginatively with the past. Royal persons are both gods and beasts. They are persons, but they are suprapersonal, carriers of a bloodline. At the most basic, they're breeding stock, collections of organs. And that brings me to the royal bodies with whom I've been most concerned recently, those of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII. Long before Kate's big news was announced, the tabloids wanted to look inside her and see if she was pregnant. And historians are still trying to peer inside the Tudors. Are they healthy? Are they sick? Can they breed? The story of Henry and his wives is peculiar to its time and place, but it's also timeless and universally understood. It's highly political and also highly personal. It's about body parts, about what fits in where and when. Are they body parts fit for purpose, or are they diseased? It's no surprise that so much fiction constellates around the subject of Henry and his wives. Often, if you want to write about women in history, you have to distort history to do it, or substitute fantasy for facts. You have to pretend that individual women were more important than they were, or that we know more about them than we do. But in the reign of King Bluebeard, you don't have to pretend. Women, their bodies, their reproductive capacities, their animal nature are central to the story. The history of the reign is so graphically gynecological that in the past it enabled lady novelists to write about sex in eras where they were only supposed to write about love. And readers could take an avid interest in what went on in royal bedrooms by dignifying it as history, therefore instructive, edifying. Popular fiction about the Tudors, and I have to be a little careful there because mine is rather popular too, but popular fiction about the Tudors has been also a form of moral teaching about women's lives, although what's taught varies with the moral fashion. It used to be in these novels that Anne Boleyn was a man-stealer who got paid out. And now the lesson is, if Catherine of Aragon had been a bit more foxy, she could have hung on to her husband. And Anne, as opportunist and sexual predator, gets recruited, oddly, to the cause of feminism. And always the writers point to the fact that a man who marries his mistress creates a job vacancy, one teaching that never falls out of fashion is women beware women. Anne Boleyn in particular is a figure who elicits a deep response, born out of ignorance often enough, but also out of empathy. I was amazed when I began to work on my Tudor books at what's out there about Anne Boleyn. The internet is abuzz with stories about her, as if everything were happening today. And her real self is hidden inside the personal dramas to which we co-opt her. There's a prurient curiosity around her, of the kind that gathered around Wallace Simpson. Henry, of course, didn't give up the throne to marry Anne, but he did reshape his nation's history. So, what was her particular attraction? Did she have a sexual secret? A special trick? Was she beautiful or ugly? Those six fingers with which she was credited were not seen during her lifetime. And the warts and the wens and the extra nipple that supposedly disfigured her were witches' marks produced by the black fantasy of Catholic propagandists. Royal bodies do change after death, and not just with the universal post-mortem decay. As it seems now, the skeleton dug up from the Leicester car park is Richard III. So now we have to concede the curved spine, which will come as a blow to the Richard III Society, who has been valorizing him for years as bonny a man as you will find in a summer's day. We have to concede the curved spine, but we don't have to concede that, as one Tudor propagandist told us, Richard was the product of a 2-year pregnancy and born with teeth. I was in a cab going to Exeter Station this morning when a news item came on the radio saying that, beyond reasonable doubt, those bones are Richard's. And my cab driver, who until then had only talked about fishing, broke off and said, "Isn't it brilliant?" And I thought, why are we all so glad? And then he supplied the answer. He said, because 20 years ago, we might not have been able to find this out. And that's it, of course. It's science and history in partnership. It's the present showing us how to access the past. And this is the essential process of history. Loss and then retrieval. One royal body recovered, first stripped by the victors and then reclothed in his real identity. And of course, it gives us hope. Because if bones can turn up, why not documents? So you can expect to see me pacing Putney High Street waiting till I feel goose pimples, and then digging up the pavement in pursuit of the lost diaries of Thomas Cromwell, aged 13 and three quarters. But back to Anne Boleyn. Her contemporaries didn't think she was a great beauty. A Venetian diplomat said this: "She's of middling stature, a swarthy complexion, long neck, wide mouth, bosom not much raised, and in fact has nothing but the English king's great appetite, and her eyes, which are black and beautiful." It was said, though not by unbiased observers, that after Anne's marriage, she aged rapidly and she grew thin. And if this is true, and we put it together with reports of a swelling in her throat, and with the description of her by one contemporary as a goggle-eyed whore, then we're looking, I think, at a woman with a hyperthyroid condition, a woman of frayed temper who lives on the end of her nerves. It often surprises people that there is no attested contemporary portrait. Just because an unknown hand has written Anne Boleyn on a picture, it doesn't mean that it's an image from life, or even an image of Anne at all. That most familiar image, in which she wears a letter B hanging from a pearl necklace, it exists in many forms and variants and originates at least 50 years after her death. So much close scrutiny, and none of it helps posterity. She's still shape-shifting centuries after her death, sculpted by the projections of those who read and write about her. Almost the first 30 years of Henry's reign were shaped by his need for a male heir. Religious and political activity constellates around that subject. All those ministers, all those bishops, all their diligence and intelligence and skill couldn't give Henry what he most needed. Only a woman could do that. But which woman? Neither of Henry's first two wives had trouble conceiving. Royal pregnancies were not announced in those days. The news crept out, and public anticipation was aroused only when the child could be felt moving. We know that Catherine of Aragon had at least six pregnancies, and most of them ended in late miscarriages or neonatal deaths. She had a son who survived for 7 weeks, but only one child made it past early infancy, and that was a daughter, the Princess Mary. Anne Boleyn's first pregnancy was successful, and it produced another girl, the Princess Elizabeth. Not success in Henry's eyes. After Elizabeth's birth, Anne miscarried at least twice. It wasn't until his third marriage to Jane Seymour that Henry had a son who lived. Both those daughters, Mary and Elizabeth, were women of great ability. And in their very different ways, they were capable of ruling. But I don't think that means Henry was wrong in his construction of the situation. What he feared was that his bloodline would end. And Elizabeth found the puzzle of who she could marry too difficult to solve. So her reign is dominated by succession crises. And she is indeed the last of the Tudors. The line did end, but just a lot later than Henry had imagined. Anne Boleyn wasn't royal by birth. Her family were city merchants, dignified into gentlefolk. And her father had married into the powerful and noble Howard family. She became royal, exalted, at her coronation, when 6 months pregnant with the future Queen Elizabeth, she walked the length of Westminster Abbey on a cloth of heaven blue. It was said that she had won Henry by promising him a son. Anne was a power player. She was a clever and determined woman. But in the end, she was valued for her body parts, not her intellect or her soul. It was her womb that was central to her story. The question is whether she could ever have won the battle for an heir, or was biology against her? At the trial of George Boleyn, Anne's brother, he entertained the court by telling them that Henry was no good in bed. Conception in those days was thought to be tied to female orgasm. So the implication was that what George called Henry's lack of skill was the problem. Yet clearly Henry was able to make his wife pregnant. So was something else wrong? The old idea that he had syphilis has been discarded a long time ago, and there never was any contemporary evidence for it. The theory was constructed only in the 19th century as part of a narrative that showed Henry as a sexual beast, justly punished for his promiscuity. In fact, Henry restrained his sexual appetites. He had few mistresses compared to the other grandees of his time. I think it was more important to him to be good, to be seen to be good, than to be gratified in this particular way. I think we can say that the old monster was a bit of a romantic. Certainly later in life, when he married Anne of Cleves, he didn't want to have sex with a woman with whom he wasn't in love. It was a scruple that baffled his contemporaries. Recently, a new hypothesis about Henry has emerged. In 2010, there was a paper in the Historical Journal called A New Explanation of the Reproductive Woes and Midlife Decline of Henry VIII. The paper suggested that Henry had a blood type called Kells positive. People who are Kells positive carry an extra antibody on the surface of their red blood cells. This blood type is rare, so it's a fair assumption that Henry's wives, like most of the population, were Kells negative. And that it's possible, if you go along with this hypothesis, that their lack of compatibility was the reason for the multiple reproductive failures. When a woman who's Kells negative conceives a child by a Kells positive man, she will, if the fetus is Kells positive, become sensitized, and her immune system will be activated and it will try to reject the fetus. The first pregnancy will go well, other things being equal. Just as with rhesus incompatibility, it takes one pregnancy for the woman to develop the sensitization. But the later children will die just before or just after birth. To a certain point, this pattern fits Henry's story. He had an illegitimate son who was perfectly healthy by Elizabeth Blunt. That was a first pregnancy. His first child with Anne Boleyn was a healthy girl, and his first child with Jane Seymour, a healthy boy. Jane died soon after Edward's birth, so we don't know what would have happened thereafter. With Catherine of Aragon, the pattern is more blurred. There's a mystery surrounding Catherine's first pregnancy. Much of the mystery was made by Catherine herself, who seemingly wanted to fudge the dates. She didn't want to admit that she'd miscarried. So we know that first pregnancy didn't work out, but we don't know what happened. It may indeed have been a twin pregnancy and failed for any number of reasons. So Catherine's one living healthy child, Mary, was not her first. But every child fathered by Henry had a chance of being Kells negative or Kells positive. And the authors of this scientific paper suggest Mary was Kells negative. That's how she survived. If this hypothesis is true, it makes the history of Henry's reign a different sort of tragedy, not a moral, but a biological tragedy inscribed on the body. The efforts of the wives and the politicians didn't avail because a genetic lottery was in operation. What makes the hypothesis persuasive to some minds is Henry's later medical history. Some individuals who are Kells positive go on to develop a collection of symptoms called MacLeod syndrome. Now, in early life, Henry was, by all accounts, a creature of great beauty. He excelled in every sport. And we wonder, of course, did his opponents let the king win? But Henry was not a fool. And though he was susceptible to flattery, he didn't need flattery of that simple kind. And besides, in a dangerous pursuit like jousting, when an armoured man and an armoured horse are charging at each other headlong, the outcome is difficult to control. So I think we can take it that he was a star. He collected a number of injuries that stopped him jousting. And then in middle age, he became stout and eventually gross. He developed, quite apart from the leg injury we know about, he also developed a weakness in his legs. By the end of his life, he was virtually immobile. It also seems to some authorities that he underwent personality changes in midlife. It was said that as a young man, he was sweet-natured. Although that claim would have had a hollow ring if you were Richard Empson or Edmund Dudley, ministers to his father, whom he executed as soon as he came to the throne. But for sure, as Henry aged, he became increasingly angry, irrational, willful, and out of control. And that fits the picture for MacLeod syndrome, the progressive muscular weakness, nerve deterioration in the lower body, depression, paranoia, and erosion of personality. Some historians see the year 1536 as a turning point for Henry, personally and politically. That was the year in which Anne Boleyn was beheaded. Certainly his later years were very sad ones for a man who'd been so magnificent and imposing. Pathology is at work, but of what kind? It does seem to me that there are more obvious explanations for his poor health and for the deterioration of his character. And that the scientists who wrote that paper didn't really understand the external pressures on the king later in his reign. Henry had suffered accidents in the tilt yard. One of his legs was permanently ulcerated. He probably had osteomyelitis, an infection in the bone. And this leg caused him chronic pain. And historians, and I'm afraid doctors too, underestimate what chronic pain can do to sour the temper and wear away both personality and intellect. When we call him paranoid, we must acknowledge he was right to think his enemies were everywhere, though he was increasingly bad at working out who they were. As for depression, he had a great deal to be depressed about, not just his isolation on the world stage, but his own decay and deterioration. He had magnificent portraits created, and he left them as his surrogates to stare down at his courtiers while he retreated into smaller, more intimate spaces. And yet he was quite unable to keep private what was happening to his own body. The royal body exists to be looked at. The world's focus on body parts was most acute and searching in the case of Jane Seymour, Henry's third wife. No one understood what Henry saw in Jane, who was not pretty and not young. The imperial ambassador suggested that after so long at Henry's court as lady-in-waiting, it was not possible that she was a virgin. And he said, no doubt, she has a very fine enigme, which is to say, secret part. So we've arrived at the crux of the matter. A royal lady is a royal vagina. And along with reverence and awe accorded to royal persons, goes the conviction that the body of the monarch is public property. We're ready at any moment to rip away that veil of respect and treat royal persons in an inhuman way, making them not more than us, but less than us, not really human at all. Is monarchy a suitable institution for a grown-up nation? I don't know. I've described to you how my own sympathies were activated and my simple ideas altered. The debate's not high on our agenda. We are happy to allow the monarchy to be an entertainment in the same way that we license strip joints and lap dancing clubs. Adulation can swing to persecution within hours, within the same press report. And this is what's happened to Prince Harry recently. You can understand that anyone treated in this way can be destabilized, and that Harry doesn't know which he is, a person or a prince. Diana was spared at least the prospect of growing old under the flash bulbs, a crime for which the media would have made her suffer. It may be that the whole phenomenon of monarchy is irrational, but that doesn't mean that when we look at it, we should behave like spectators at bedlam. Cheerful curiosity can easily become cruelty, can easily become fatal. We don't cut off the heads of royal ladies these days, but we do sacrifice them. And we did memorably drive one to destruction a scant generation ago. History makes fools of us, makes puppets of us, often enough but it doesn't have to repeat itself. In the current case, much lies within our control. I'm not asking for censorship. I'm not asking for pious humbug or smarmy reverence. I'm asking us to back off and not be brutes. So get your pink frilly frocks out. Zhuzh up your platinum locks. We have all Barbara Cartland now. The pen is in our hands, and a happy ending is ours to write. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. For more, go to lrb.co.uk